Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The annual checkup is a familiar routine for many. You go to the doctor's office, you get your checkup, the doctor talks to you about your condition, if you have one, and discusses treatment options. You nod, and then you return home. The problem, most patients can't remember pretty much 80% of what they hear during the checkup, and often they don't understand what they can remember, and that affects the quality of health care. What if patients could get a memo or a prescription of the information they're given during a checkup? Molly Mettler is the former senior vice president of HealthWise, Inc. That's a nonprofit consumer health information company, and she's a contributing health writer for The Wall Street Journal. She recently wrote about the idea of information prescriptions, and she joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Ann Fisher.
This isn't a call for more information. This is a call for the information to be written down, right?
It's a call for the information to be as specifically targeted for the individual patient as possible and for it to come in a form that will work best for that patient, whether it's in the form of a written prescription or an electronic prescription or, say, even a video.
When did this get to be an issue? Has it always been a problem, or is it something more recent?
Well, what you said in your introduction about how most of us simply cannot retain what we're told in the doctor's office, that has been a long-term problem. And 15 years ago, my co-author, Donald W. Kemper, and I wrote a book proposing that the information that a doctor shares with a patient is as important as any pill she might prescribe or any test or any surgery. And we said that information, if it's prescription strength, is therapeutic. And it's not about care. It is care. And so we were suggesting that information be treated just like a pill might be treated, that you could dose it to the right person at the right time to help them make a decision. So the idea is taking good information, vetted, evidence-based information, and getting it to that person in a way that will help her make the best healthcare decision for her.
Can you give me an example of how this might play out?
Sure. I'll give you an example of care without information prescriptions and care with information prescriptions,
okay,
because I bet many of your listeners will recognize this scenario, and it comes from my own experience. I am a bad skier, but I am a hopeful skier. Anyway, I blew out my knee.
Ooh.
Yeah, well, it happens. And in the process of trying to decide how to get my torn ACL fixed, I met with one surgeon who proposed a very aggressive surgery. I was scared of that. I went to another surgeon who proposed something less dramatic. But it all turned out in the end that an MRI indicated that I could try physical therapy without having surgical intervention, and that was the route I went for. And in the process of getting this reprieve from having surgery, I also learned that I had a condition called osteopenia, or weakening bones. It's very common around women of my advanced age and my frame size. It's the precursor for osteoporosis. Anyway, so there I am. I have two suggestions for surgery. I have a suggestion for physical therapy, and I also have a new problem that I was unaware of. But at no time during the course of these conversations did I get any particular information about the pros and cons of different surgical approaches. No one really sat down and said, well, what's important to you? What are you willing to do to bring your knee back to health? And at no time did anyone say, hey, look, we found this diagnosis of osteopenia. Do you want to start working on that? It was left to me to sort of stumble my way through figuring out a decision and a process that would bring me back to good health. Now, that is, I'm afraid, a typical doctor-patient encounter. Mm-hmm. You get a diagnosis, you get a recommendation for the doc from the doctor, and then you're left to decide, how do you want to go about this? With information prescriptions or information therapy, at each point along the way, I would have been dosed or given information particular to where I was in the decision-making process. For instance, if a particular surgery was suggested, I could have gotten a written or electronically delivered information prescription that would say, here's what we know about this surgery. Here are the pros and cons. Here are the recovery rates. Here's what percent of people have a return to total knee health. And here are the risks. I would have been able to factor in my preferences into the decision. I would have also been given, once diagnosed with the osteopenia, I would have been given an information prescription, say, for bone-strengthening diet and exercises and medications that work for that condition. But as it was, I actually worked for a health information company, mm-hmm. so I was in a good position to go find good information. But I think we believe it's important to treat that level of information as a part of the care that you receive. And it's our position that if you're not getting that information, then your care is incomplete.
It sounds like, Molly Mettler, that this is more work for the doctors.
Well, the doctors thought that originally as well, especially with the rise of the healthcare websites at the beginning of the dot-com boom. Mm-hmm. They were afraid of patients coming in with great file folders of information. But as it has turned out, with the help of the electronic medical record, doctors are able, with the click of a button or, you know, the pointing of a mouse, to deliver very specific information prescriptions tied to a diagnosis or to a particular procedure. These have been arranged and are now embedded in electronic medical records. Whether the doctor is taking advantage of them is another question.
Okay, because I get them sometimes.
Yes. We would hope you would get them always.
How, when you talk about dosing of this information, what do you mean by that? You said dose it in the right amounts at the right time.
Well, so often when we go in to see a doctor, we may go in with a big problem or a small problem, and it's quite easy to have a fire hose turned on us. Say, you need to consider this and that. Big chronic conditions like diabetes are especially susceptible to that kind of fire hose approach of all the things you need to do. Well, people are at different stages of readiness for their willingness, their ability, their capacity for making behavioral changes or making decisions about some conditions. So ideally, you would get information targeted to where you are in your decision-making journey. Now, of course, if you have a broken leg, it's not a question of, well, how do you want to treat this? Mm-hmm. But for most conditions, there's a gray area. It's not black and white. It's patient preference sensitive. It's what the patient believes that will work best for him or her. So dosing the information means that they get it at just the moment where they need to make the next decision in their care.
Is this something that you want patients to go out and start requesting?
I think that an educated, empowered, fired up patient is the best thing for the doctor and the best thing for our healthcare system. Patients who are engaged in their own healthcare will get better healthcare. Educated patients, informed patients will not only get better care, but they'll get better quality care and help to improve the quality within our healthcare system. I also think that ultimately an educated patient will save money. So yeah, I do want consumers to request this.
But, you know, a lot of people don't feel comfortable asking something of their doctor like that.
Well, that's true. And there are big generational differences in people's level of comfort in sort of pressing for information or pressing for a second decision. But on the whole, the consumer, the face of the consumer is changing. We've got consumers now who are not only asking for information and choice about their ways to handle their healthcare problems, but they also want more control and they want customer service. And healthcare systems are really looking at pleasing the ultimate customer of healthcare, who's the patient. So I think that we are at a point now in history where all the factors have come together. You've got an informed, you've got a customer base that wants control and information, and you've got the technology in place through the electronic medical record to make this easier. Plus, there are federal regulations in place that preceded Obamacare, as a matter of fact, meaningful use of the electronic medical record that requires physicians to be able to prescribe patient-specific information. So it's not only a right of the consumer, the patient, but it's a requirement of the healthcare system and of the doctor to provide it.
Are doctors aware of the low retention rate for information given during an exam?
Well, that's a good question. I would think that doctors have a very good sense of what their patients as a whole are capable of doing. The trouble or the danger might be in underestimating people's interest levels or their ability to care for themselves. Hmm. When we talk about information therapy, we look at it from what would the physician think of as a good prescription, a good information prescription. And then we also look at it from what the patient needs. And they're two different things. Physicians need to know that the information that they are prescribing is safe and evidence-based, that it has been reviewed by other physicians, and sort of, yes, this is all correct, and that it's up to date. They want to know that. Patients, from their point of view, they need information that's easy to use and easy to understand and helps them make a decision. So you have to have those two pieces working together to meet the needs of both the physician and the patient.
John in Columbus, you're on the air with Molly Mettler, health writer for the Wall Street Journal. Hi, John.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I completely agree with everything that has been said. I think it's, I'm a nurse at Ohio State, and you know, I think it's our obligation as healthcare providers to give information. Mm-hmm. But what I'd like to speak about is you can give as many books or papers, you know, if you can stack it up to the ceiling with information about a procedure, surgery, you know, diagnoses, whatever. Mm-hmm. But it all comes down to the patient's willingness to take that information and go home and actually understand it. And, you know, if they're not willing, then essentially I'm, you know, I think we're just wasting paper. And I'll take my comment off air.
Yeah, Molly Mettler, kind of got to get people rethinking about what their role is in all of this.
Well, I'm so glad to hear John's support for the informed and empowered patient. And as a health professional, you probably see almost on a daily basis the positives that come with having an engaged patient. And you're absolutely right. If you give them a stack of books up to the ceiling, most people, almost everybody, would just recoil in horror. It's like, what am I supposed to do?
That's what I pay you the big bucks for, yeah. Right?
But the whole idea behind an information prescription, again, is that it is targeted and it speaks directly to that patient with that patient's preferences in mind. So one way that can get people engaged in following through is through a system we call patient response. If you can deliver information in such a way that lets the patient individually answer questions. This is how I feel about surgery. This is how strong I feel about my capacity to do physical therapy. This is my fear. If we could open it up for that patient to be herself, to be her own sovereign self in the midst of this interaction, and to capture her reactions, her responses, and then factor that into the decision-making process, I think you'll get people who are more engaged and willing to participate.
Molly Mettler, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Okay, I appreciate your interest in this. And good health, everybody.
Molly Mettler is a contributing health writer for The Wall Street Journal, former senior vice president of HealthWise, Inc. That's a nonprofit consumer health information company. We'll have a link to her article about the idea of information prescriptions after a medical appointment. Go to the website at WOSU.org/allsides. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Roughly 25 million Americans suffer from asthma, and there's still no cure for the chronic lung disease that's costing the country billions of dollars. But some new and old methods are emerging to manage the disease. For some asthmatics, respite may come from simply going to higher ground. Van Newkirk II is a writer for The Atlantic. He recently wrote about new methods for treating asthma. I'll have a link to his article at WOSU.org/allsides. And Van joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So there's still no cure for asthma. Why isn't there a cure? Why is it so elusive?
Well, I think the one thing to remember here is that while asthma presents as a very common sort of inset of symptoms, asthma attacks, it actually, you know, functions differently in different people. There's elements of the immune system involved. And I think just like other diseases and disorders where the immune system is involved, we still haven't quite figured out a way to get ahead of it. So there are ways to mitigate the symptoms and the attacks, but figuring out a way to, say, stop a person's immune system or their lungs from developing in the way that would create asthma, we haven't quite gotten there.
I lived in Arizona for a few years back in the early 80s, and back then a lot of people were still moving there because of the air. Eventually, though, that changed because so many people were bringing in the plants and growing them there that were causing a lot of the problems. So what is it about the environment?
Yeah, so what we know, and it's, you know, a reiteration of some of the oldest therapies on the books, is that getting out to cleaner air, to higher air, to mountain air, to nature, it actually is very good for the lungs of asthmatics. And like you alluded to, there actually have been mass movements west, sort of, for sanatorium reasons, for health reasons, and they end up sort of creating the very situations of pollution that end up that made people move in the first place. So there's a bit of irony there. But one of the sort of most effective ways that we know right now, aside from using inhalers, nebulizers, things like that, for controlling asthma is getting out of unclean getting out of unclean air and also from low areas.
Well, so that stands to reason then that people who live in physically crummy environments where there's industrial waste, that kind of a thing, older buildings where they're not being cleaned properly, lower income people suffer from asthma at a much higher rate than others, right?
Right. And some of the key factors for who develops asthma and their likelihood of having asthma over the course of their lifetime are things like whether they live next to highways, whether they live in cities where there's smog. And so obviously I think the although lots of people can't, say, go out to the mountains or to Arizona to clear their asthma up, we know the most effective way from a public health perspective of reducing the prevalence of asthma is to reduce pollution.
Mm-hmm. You visited Denver, Colorado, where people have gone to escape the symptoms of asthma, you know, Mile High, Denver. What makes it a good place?
So Denver it's a bit of a mixed bag. So it does have, it's higher than other places. It's really high, and that's actually really good. So a person from Denver that went to a city with comparable pollution would do better with their asthma than people who live there currently. But Denver also has lots of pollution. And I think people refer to the brown cloud when you go into Denver, like it sits there in the bowl by the mountains. But also, in addition to that, one of the good things is you can sort of get out of that brown cloud pretty easily. You can go up, you can hike the mountains, you can get out to open wilderness, nature, and clean air pretty easily. And that's something that a person, say, in New York can't do as easily.
So could somebody then actually seek respite? So go there for a week for a vacation. If you have asthma, go somewhere where you can give yourself a break. It'll still help you down the road.
Yeah, so actually the evidence says that it takes about 12 weeks to build up sort of a useful response. But also, I think what the science shows is that during the course of living, say, at high altitude or in nature, things get better. So while you may not be able to go back to, say, where you live and have a better response for your asthma, have fewer attacks, you can at least get respite. So you can go to, say, an asthma camp, train your lungs up a little bit. You can go hiking, things like that. And they have been shown to make life a little bit better for people with asthma.
You have asthma, I read that you had an attack while reporting on this story. What happened? How did it affect your breathing when you were in Denver?
Yeah, so I've had asthma as long as I can remember, and it's always been triggered by my allergies, including my food allergies. So I'm usually pretty good about avoiding my food allergies, as a person with them should be. But while I was there, I accidentally ate some crab guacamole, and it was one of those things where, you know, I haven't had an attack in quite some time, and it's so familiar when it sneaks up on you. And so I knew exactly what was happening. Actually, the good thing was I just spent the day talking to experts about asthma, and so it was on my mind, and, you know, I went and got it treated and took care of myself pretty quickly.
In your article, you write that severe asthma sufferers belong to what you call the platinum patients. What do you mean by that?
So what we at The Atlantic are calling the platinum patients are they're about 5% of patients who make up about half of all medical expenditures. So there's a very small pool of people who we spend the most on healthcare for them. They have chronic conditions. They have these things that keep them in hospitals and make them go to emergency rooms. And people who have severe asthma who go to the emergency room regularly for asthma attacks, they are among that group.
And what's the significance of that? Meaning if we could affect the outcomes for the, more of those people, we're affecting a big outcome for the cost of healthcare in the United States.
Right. People think about healthcare costs as this big, giant thing that's impossible to get ahead of. But really, you could cut, say if you cut half of the expenditures for those so-called platinum patients, you cut our total expenditures by 25%. That's huge. So if you could do things like reduce the amount of asthma attacks from people with severe asthma by like half over a year, these are things that are doable. And I think once you sort of break it down and into discrete little bites like that, it makes the problem of health expenditures much more easy to deal with and to manage and to think about from a policy perspective.
You write that the concept of high-altitude climate therapy suggests that not only do asthmatics benefit from reduced allergens at high altitudes, but that they become less sensitive to existing allergens. How does that work? What's going on there?
So, right. So when you're in higher altitudes, you have fewer allergens like smog and certain insects just don't live as well at high altitudes. And the air is just more likely to carry them away from you. But also what the science shows is that having thinner air, having sort of condition your lungs to breathe more efficiently at altitude, it makes them, makes you more able to deal with attacks in the future. It also, having fewer allergens changes your body's sort of immunological makeup. It makes you less sensitive to those allergens in the future. So it's twofold there.
You visited the National Jewish Health in Denver and met with Dr. Todd Olin, a pulmonologist who helps train people to cope with asthma attacks. What does that involve? Is that what you're talking about with thinner air, or is it something different?
So that their training there doesn't quite involve the thinner air, since most of the patients are already from the Denver area.
Mm-hmm.
But what they're doing there is, you know, I think one of the big issues with asthma is people with asthma tend to self-limit. Lots of people will tell you, I've never had an attack, but that's because they never do any physical activity. They never go outside. They end up developing all these comorbidities. It's like obesity, end up with heart disease. Those are the things that end up killing asthmatics. So identifying those things early and helping kids especially learn how to engage in physical activity, learn their triggers, learn when they're having an attack, and learn how to be responsible about their asthma while also engaging in physical activity. That's what his lab does. And so there's a lot of advanced science going on there, but also some pretty basic stuff. They have kids on treadmills. They identify kids who may not actually have asthma, who have symptoms similar to asthma, that can actually be cleared up through just being cognizant of how you breathe. So there's a lot of different factors there, but really the goal there is to get people active and to not let them self-limit because of their asthma.
When you were a kid, did you avoid what you thought were triggers?
Oh, all the time. And it was, you know, I think any asthmatic can identify here, especially during allergy season, when it was hot out, when pollen was out, I did not go outside. And people would be outside playing baseball. You know, I would either have to pump myself full of Benadryl in order to make it, or I'd stay inside. And that's common. I think people, especially after they've had attacks, they don't go upstairs. And it's not even a conscious decision often. Mm-hmm. It becomes so baked into your activities and your mindset that it just becomes natural for you.
Did you eventually change your behavior?
So I'm one of the people who's lucky enough where my asthma got less severe over time with age. And so by high school and college, I was able to engage in collegiate athletics without the fear of regular attacks. That's not the case for lots of people.
Mm-hmm.
So they may never be able to sort of engage in peak level physical activity.
You know, sometimes in the movies we see as people who have asthma as being affected emotionally under high stress, their asthma is what triggers it. Is that a real thing?
That's a real thing. So there's lots of different triggers for asthma.
Mm-hmm.
One could be, like the movies say, anxiety. Although I think anyone with asthma will recognize that the media portrayal of people with asthma is sort of way off base.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's lots of things that can trigger asthma. Anxiety, being in awkward social situations is one of them, but I think most people would say the most common trigger are, say, allergies, people who go outside, people who have intense physical activity. There's a typecast of who is an asthmatic, but actually athletes are more likely to be asthmatic than anybody else.
Why is that?
I don't think anybody knows yet, but it may just be a phenomenon of they're more likely to be involved in activities that trigger asthma, so they just get diagnosed more.
There is a shortage of healthcare providers in poorer areas, coupled with potential changes to Medicaid that cover most pediatric asthma hospitalizations as Congress considers repealing and replacing the Affordable Care Act. But researchers at National Jewish had some solutions for that, too. What did they say?
Right. So they were thinking about ways to involve health extenders and parents. So people who aren't necessarily involved in, say, hospital care, people who aren't doctors, people who aren't RNs, because really, I think where most people learn how to manage their asthma and where most people have their attacks, they aren't in healthcare settings. They're in schools. So one of the things that people at National Jewish, I think they recommended was getting, say, school nurses and teachers involved in both educating students who have asthma and managing their asthma, and in identifying and providing information to the healthcare system about what triggers them and their asthma profile. So really, it makes sense, and it's a casualty of how fractured our healthcare system is that it doesn't happen more. We have about 10% of the population has asthma, a bit higher of a proportion of kids have it. Why not use schools as the first place for them to learn about it, where they learn everything else?
So they've shown that that's helpful. Is it something that's being adopted?
Well, it's limited right now by some medical privacy laws and by just how utterly incompatible lots of pieces of our medical system are with schools. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think there have been some successes, and there are states and different school districts who are looking into finding ways around those obstacles now.
Jim in Upper Arlington, you're on the air with Van Newkirk II, a staff writer for The Atlantic. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Ann. Really interested in this conversation. I have just a quick question. I graduated from high school back in the 60s, you know, the Stone Ages. And I had a friend who was pretty bad asthmatic. He stayed around Columbus for about 8 or 9 years till he got his college degree. He moved into Bar Harbor, Maine, where he has lived all of his life. And his life has been so much normalized. The air is clean. It's a salty air. Can that help an asthmatic? My question.
Van Newkirk?
Yeah, so actually one of the therapies that I tried on myself when I was in Denver was called halo therapy. It's where people, when you go to this sort of spa and inhale salt crystals. It didn't work for me. I didn't quite like it, but there are people who swear by it. And there is evidence, I think, that living, say, inhaling salt spray is something that actually helps lots of asthmatics deal with their symptoms. And again, it's that whole thing of cleaner air. Mm-hmm. Lots of places where you can go to the beach, where you can go, say, to Maine and live by the salt spray. They have fewer allergens, they have less pollutants, and so they're just better places to be generally, absent the sort of more fuzzy benefits of inhaling the ocean spray.
I remember my son had some childhood asthma, and you know, they had the albuterol nebulizer treatments, but a lot of times just some saline solution worked almost just as well for him.
Yeah, that worked for me a lot. Again, every asthmatic has a different profile and different needs, and they respond to different therapies. But I think these sort of really old basic principles for treating the illness, you know, they've always been effective, and they haven't really gone away.
Jim, thanks a lot for that call. Van Newkirk, thanks to you. Appreciate your time today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Van Newkirk II is a staff writer for The Atlantic. We'll have his article about asthma and treatments for it on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. We have more Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Eat more fish, walk 10,000 steps a day, drink coffee, don't drink coffee, red wine, but not too much. Some lifestyle recommendations are more legitimate than others, but even the experts are guilty of overgeneralizations. Monica Reinagle is a nutritionist, chef, and creator of the Nutrition Diva podcast. She recently wrote about the disease proofing myth on her website, nutritionovereasy.com. You can check out the link at WOSU.org/allsides. Monica Reinagle joins us by phone. Welcome back, Monica.
Hi, Ann. Thanks for having me today.
So what's the disease proofing myth?
Well, you know, we have all of this information about things that we can do to reduce our risk of various diseases, you know, especially the ones that we are most scared about, like cancer or Alzheimer's disease. And that's a great thing to have because, you know, we can take steps, we can empower ourselves to reduce our risk. But often I think that these sorts of recommendations for how you can reduce your risk of breast cancer, of heart disease, get a little overpackaged into what I call the disease-proofing myth, which suggests that avoiding a given disease is simply a matter of doing everything right. You know, that if you just follow the rules closely enough, then you don't have to worry about this anymore. And that sort of implies that if you do get sick, it's your fault. And I don't think that that's necessarily true or helpful. And I think that it's sort of a little bit of a misunderstanding about what risk reduction really is about and what we do know about how we get sick and why we get sick.
How did we start confusing risk reduction with disease proof?
An interesting question. I think there may be two factors. One, as you know, consumers, we are very eager to hear information about what we could do to reduce our risk. You know, it's just the kinds of things that keep people up at night, in the middle mm-hmm. of the night. And we see people around us that we love succumbing to diseases, and we want to make sure that we never have to suffer like that or to prevent others that we love from suffering. So we're really hungry for this information, and that creates a kind of demand. That demand then gets supplied, as that's how demands work, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so people who do research in this area, and you know, epidemiologists and medical experts and public health policy people get sort of sucked into this tendency to present these recommendations as protocols. You know, they sell books, and you can sell a lot more books by saying, you know, follow these rules and never have to worry about breast cancer than you can by saying, follow these rules and hope for the best. So I think there's a few different things at play. You know, researchers are definitely succumb to the temptation to maybe overpromise a little bit what these lifestyle factors can do. And I don't mean to rain on anybody's parade or be a cold shower here. I think that when we can take steps to reduce our risk, we should. You know, that's something positive that we can do. I just think it's important to remind people that diet and lifestyle are really just one of many factors that go into our risk for various diseases, and some of those risk factors we can't control. So it's important to be realistic about this.
Is there a difference in your mind between things that are lifestyle enhancing versus disease proofing?
Tell me a little bit more about what you mean.
So
by
I quit smoking cigarettes. I feel better. maybe I'll reduce my risk for cancer, maybe I won't, but I also feel better. So we're kind of in this thing where we're looking for the something that's going to make us live forever, when really, I mean, shouldn't we be more focused on just living better now?
That the payoff, yes, can be sooner. Yeah, that's a great point. You know, something may not guarantee that we never get sick, but if it enhances our quality of life now and reduces our risk, even if we can't reduce our risk to zero, that's a win-win. But that raises another interesting point, Anne, and that is that if something that you might do that would statistically reduce your risk of a disease, but it's making you miserable, you know, that may not be worth it. Now, I'm not saying, you know, if not smoking makes you miserable, you should just go ahead and smoke. But, you know, we can work, hard to follow these rules. And if it's really impacting our quality of life, our ability to, you know, enjoy meals with our families or, you know, relax and enjoy life, I'm not sure that trade-off is worth it because, as I said, we're not reducing our risk to zero. So, you know, I think that we want to balance our risk reduction efforts with maintaining a good quality of life along the way.
You've reviewed protocols that claim to reduce risks of Alzheimer's, cancer, diabetes, infertility. The list goes on. Is there a common thread among researchers for how these protocols are tested? I mean, is there a way for everyday people to tell a difference?
Well, that's just it. Most of these protocols are not tested in the kind of, you know, clinical experiment where we put some people on one diet and some people on another and then see what happens. These are observations that they cull out of big data sets. This is medical data mining, where we have a lot of information about tens of thousands of people over decades about what they ate in general, and then what happened to them. And so epidemiologists mine all that data to see if they can see the trends, and then they package those all up as protocols. You know, that's all well and good. And so much of it turns out to just kind of repeat the general healthy mantra that we, you know, are constantly reinforcing. There's very few surprises here, right? Eat more vegetables, don't drink too much soda, maintain a healthy body weight. So in some senses, it can get a little repetitive and redundant. But every once in a while, something strange comes up. For example, when they analyzed the dietary data and the incidence of Alzheimer's disease, they found that people who ate a lot of cheese had a higher risk of Alzheimer's disease. Now, in my mind, that alone may not be reason enough to give up cheese because, you know, cheese.
Yeah, right.
But at the same time, but they did the same process and analyzed dietary data, and they saw that eating more cheese actually reduced the risk of infertility. So that was one case where the recommendations didn't necessarily line up. So you'd have to decide whether you were more interested in getting pregnant or avoiding Alzheimer's disease. Or maybe as soon as you get pregnant, you can start working on avoiding Alzheimer's disease. But yeah, but it does show that these are observations, these are correlations, and that we have to take them with a grain of salt.
What about our genetic propensity for disease?
Exactly.
Is that something we should be paying more and more attention to?
Well, we are paying more attention to it, especially now because people, you know, can send off a cheek swab for $100 and get a DNA profiling done.
Right.
And it's definitely a player, a big player in whether, you know, there a lot of your risk of heart disease has to do with what goes with your genes and not with, you know, whether you're putting butter and sour cream on your potato. So it's a big factor. My question is, what can we do? We can't really affect it. You know, you can't change your genes. So it's useful information, but I think we just need to kind of be aware that that's one of those risk factors that we can't change. So, you know, knowing your genetic propensity, if it allows you to take steps or prioritize your health behaviors, you know, that's certainly worthwhile, but unfortunately, we're not at a point yet where we can go in and rewrite that code.
Exactly. There is a big movement toward buying organic foods because they're healthier or even more helpful in preventing the development of certain kinds of diseases. And I was wondering, To what degree do we know that's true? Is this something that's been studied?
Actually, we pretty much know it's not true.
Okay.
So there is a big movement towards buying organic foods, but it is a myth that eating organic produce reduces your risk of cancer. It doesn't. We have studied it. It doesn't impact cancer risk. There may be other good reasons to do that. For example, just reducing the amount of pesticides that are in our used in our environment, mm-hmm. and maybe making conditions on farms healthier for farm workers. You know, this and the soil healthier. There's good reasons to support organic farming, but that's the number one reason that people give, is that, you know, they feel like by choosing organic, they're reducing their risk of cancer. And ironically, it doesn't.
Right. It's a lot more about the environment.
In terms of the benefits?
Yeah.
Yeah, and the impact on wildlife. But here's an ironic thing. You know, sometimes people are so afraid of non-organic produce because they have this idea that it will, you know, literally give you cancer, that they will eat less vegetables because they can't get organic. And that is actually, the absolute opposite of the truth. You are far better off eating more vegetables, even if those vegetables are conventionally grown, than you are limiting your vegetable consumption in order to eat only organic. The benefits of the fruits and vegetables far outweigh any potential risk from exposure to the pesticides, which is minimal.
Couples waiting longer to start trying to get pregnant, they're going to face fertility problems, not always, mm-hmm. but sometimes. How does diet affect fertility levels?
Well, age certainly can play into it, but really, I'm not a fertility expert, but I've certainly interviewed many of them, and what I'm hearing from them is that the number one factor in growing fertility rates is not even the fact that we're waiting longer to start our families, but that both parents are more likely to be overweight. And that has a profound risk on, a profound effect on fertility. Being underweight can also make it really difficult to get pregnant, but when we look at our society, the greater proportion of adults is overweight, and that appears to be a big driver of the sort of infertility crisis. And so one of the big things that you can do to improve your chances of conceiving is to get yourself to a normal weight, and that goes for the guys too.
Do we know why that is?
Having more fat tissue on your body can affect all kinds of, organs and hormonal profiles in the body. It's complex. I don't know if they've really teased out exactly what all of the different mechanisms are, but the association is too strong to question.
You know, you've said that something you didn't explore in this piece, but that might be interesting to talk about, is the extent to which the disease-proofing myth influences public policy. You know, lawmakers out there saying, well, if people would just lose weight, they wouldn't have this problem, or whatever, you know, pick your disease-proofing myth. What about that?
Well, this is very much in my mind right now as I watch our lawmakers debate healthcare reform. And one of the big sticking points that they're hung up on is, what should we do about people who have pre-existing conditions? And is it fair to ask them to pay more? And I have heard lawmakers express the opinion that that if you have a pre-existing condition, then paying higher premiums is simply the consequence that you have to bear for having made poor choices. And to me, that telegraphs that these lawmakers have also fallen into the disease-proofing myth. They believe that if you're sick, it's because you didn't take good care enough of yourself, and that taking good care of yourself ensures that you will never get sick. And, you know, with just a couple of exceptions, our lawmakers aren't health professionals. They get their health information the same place everybody else does, you know, on the internet, from their friends. And so they are subject to the same sort of myths. And this I see as a real danger a way in which this debate is being hijacked a little bit. So I think it's worth, raising that point that sometimes people can do everything right and get sick anyway. And so, you know, we need to take that into consideration when we're making broad generalizations and trying to fashion a bill that we, or fashion an approach to healthcare that we feel is fair.
Monica Reinagle, thanks as always. Appreciate your time today.
Thanks, Anne.
Monica Reinagle, nutritionist, chef, and creator of the Nutrition Diva podcast, will have a link to her website at WOSU.org/All Sides. Thanks for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.